Shoes.
Recorded live.
Well, welcome everybody to the Monday questionnaire for Fair Recovery Center. And today we've got a number of questions here, so we'll get going on this thing. For those of you calling from out of state, I see there's a few. Thank you. I'm glad you're here. I don't know where the Texans are today. We don't have any of them online, so maybe they'll get their act together later on. And I am watching the, for those of you online, I'm going to be watching the screen here. So if you have something you want to, a question, put it into chat if you can do that. Okay, so to begin, the first question today is a long one. Yeah, it's been 17 months since discovery. The only reason I know anything about his affair is because I've asked questions and he chooses what he wants to tell me. He gets very defensive when I ask him questions and tells me that I won't ever be able to get over it. He's never sat and told me when the affair started, how things happened. We went to the January EMS, and the night before I found out some information that I didn't know before, and that was his affair partner was married at the time but separated from her husband, supposedly. I've told him many, many times that he needs to tell me everything because every time I find out new information, it takes me back to the day I found out, and I feel like I'm starting all over. I also feel like he's still lying about information about his affair. I'm not sure that I believe that this was the only one. I asked him if he would take a lie detector test, and he went ballistic and said it was a violation of his privacy. He lied to me for 11 years and then lied to me many times about a contact with the affair partner after discovery. I don't know if I really believe he loves me and is not just staying out because of our daughter and financially what this will do to him. How do I get him to start at the beginning and tell me everything about his affair on his own without me asking questions, since he didn't do a very good job the EMS weekend? Also, how do I get him to understand that I need to know he's telling me the truth about the affair and if he really loves me, etc.? Also, when I ask him questions, he really gets pissed off and says he can't take anymore and is leaving and divorcing me. He has done this probably 10 to 15 times since discovery. It makes me feel like he doesn't understand how this affected my life, and it's just easier for him to leave than to try to do things I need him to do so that I can start to feel safe again. The, you know, anytime you've got somebody that is having trouble sharing the information, the problem is the way you begin to rebuild trust is you first start by trusting the other person with information. And so it's really sad to me that he's still choosing not to give the information. Also, information that's given voluntarily ultimately really begins to reveal kind of a sense of loyalty. I mean, where's the loyalty? And in the long run, one of the things that I say in order for there to be a reconnection in the relationship, I think there needs to be a willingness on the unfaithful mate's part to be about trying to help their mate to heal. So when you have somebody that I think doesn't necessarily want to give information, then and doesn't want to tell the story, I mean, at one level for you, I suspect it makes you feel like that the loyalty is still more to the affair partner than it is back to you. And I think that would be quite normal. And especially when there's the defensiveness. And so for whatever reason, there is still a disconnect kind of about what he does or he doesn't need to do. I mean, you know, if someone really wants a relationship, then I think they're willing to make sacrifices and kind of do what's necessary. Now, let me give you one caveat to all of this. There are some people that psychologically are so damaged themselves that it's very, very difficult for them to end up beginning this process. At that point, what I want with someone who just can't talk about it and continues to use all kinds of defense mechanisms to push you away is I would at least hope they would be willing to get into therapy themselves to begin to heal. They just almost need to be in some sort of therapy, I think, to work through why the heck they can't be real and they can't be honest about it. And when you've got somebody who really can't be real in that sense, what's happening is they're dealing with a tremendous amount of shame. So I just think that, you know, if at the very least, I would hope that maybe they would do some individual counseling to begin to figure out what they need to do to be able to be real, to address it, to not go into a shame cycle, because, you know, apparently every time you bring it up, you know, he's kicking off into the amygdala. He's kicking off into this whole fight or flight, defensive, near feed place and just kind of blowing up the world. And he's got to figure out ultimately why he is doing that. I was actually talking to a woman in San Antonio whose husband kind of has the same response. I mean, he doesn't want to be with the affair partner, but his ability to still, for the two of them to talk about it and address it is still very limited. And it's not limited because of her. It's not that she's not even safe to talk about it. The problem is he still has such an intense shame core that every time they do try to talk about it, he blows up, gets defensive. I mean, he can't control his own emotional flooding at that point in time. But to his credit, I would certainly tip my hat simply because he is working very hard in therapy trying to figure out what causes him to explode whenever his wife talks with him. And she and I have been working very hard about how does she not ask questions at this point, simply because there's not anything positive that's going to be able to come because of his brokenness almost from the question-answer place. I mean, they're stuck there. And so she and I have agreed we're leaving the questions on the table for a year, and he knows that. I mean, it's a kind of a thing that's happening. She's leaving the questions on the table for a year, you know, while he does his own individual work, trying to get to the place ultimately where he can talk about it without flooding. So that would be the other thing that I would say that might be helpful is him getting into individual therapy. You know, I don't know in your question here, I don't know if I really believe he loves me and is just staying with me because of our daughter and financially what this would do to him. You know, I would just say a very tough question on that. I mean, maybe he does. I mean, if he's truly shame-based, the very fact, and he may not know much of what love is, but the very fact that he's trying to do some of this, maybe it's somewhat in his mind due to love as he understands it. I'm not sure. But definitely he's going to need help, and hopefully you know, he can at least agree to that. Not couples, I'd almost say individual in a situation like this. Well, we've got this 17 month thing going today. That's a time period that concerns me. It's been 18 months since discovery, and on the whole, my husband and I are doing pretty well. He's patient in talking and understanding when I get triggered. One thing I'm still wrestling with is the sadness over the loss of the sanctity of our marriage and the feeling of numbness that it can still bring to me and a cheapness about our marriage. Is this normal? And if so, what can I do to alleviate it? Is it likely to dissipate over time? Thanks for your input. absolutely, it's very likely to dissipate over time. It's almost like as you build and walk together and you experience life together, people begin to move forward. And also the triggers continue to go down. I would be a little concerned not knowing, you know, how many triggers you have at this point. Because if there are still a lot of triggers happening, then I'd be kind of concerned maybe about some trauma that you might have. But there just is a loss about the sanctity of marriage. But part of the last stage of grieving is acceptance and kind of transformation of that loss. And you don't get to or through grieving by avoidance. The way you get through grieving is far more by, I think, still walking through it, but also looking and trying to see God in it. You just want to begin to see maybe how God is using it and how, in terms of a bigger picture, there's a lot, there are things that you gain from that. So hopefully you'll begin to see some of the transformation of that loss in the near future, because at that point, it's no longer about the loss of the sanctity of the marriage. It's about, in some ways, as it transforms kind of the ways that you go forward from this enriched, better equipped, with new understandings of love, with feeling like there's even maybe more meaning in your life now than there was before, a deeper understanding, a deeper maturity, a deeper connection with your mate. I know that having destroyed the sanctity of our marriage, Stephanie would always say, you know, it's the best, it's the worst thing that ever happened, it's the best thing that ever happened, simply because it transformed us. And it began to be a place where we finally became a we, in a sense that we had never been before. That didn't happen all in the first year or 2 years. That process kept moving forward. The only other thing that I might suggest is you want to make sure in your own heart that you've tried to release. It sounds like you probably have, but that you're trying to, you're not trying to hang on. To protect yourself by being unforgiven, because that'll kind of sustain it. That's almost like the control, the bargaining. That's not acceptance is the final stage of grief, not trying to manage. It's a letting go. And it may feel that you're not quite at the place where it's safe enough to totally let go and trust. But I do know that eventually you want to begin to focus your thoughts, again, on the transformation piece of it. And also, you don't want to live around this thing. You want to live from this thing. You want this to be something that ultimately, in a very strange way, the two of you can talk about. It's not emotional because that is healed. And you begin to see some sort, in a strange way, even a benefit. And I hope you can find that soon. A room for recovery, enmeshed co-addict. That's an interesting one. Let's see. It's been 2 weeks since my husband made full disclosure of his 9 sexual partners. I am so sorry. I wake up every morning and tell him how hurt I am and point out why a specific detail of his acting out hurt me. He finally told me that he understands that I would want to tell him how hurt I am, but that he does not want to hear me talk about details anymore. I realize my husband and I are each responsible for our own recovery, and I suspect that it's unrealistic for me to expect to be comforted by the very person who's caused me so much pain. So in response to my husband's request, I've completely turned my attention to prayer, affirmations, journaling, reading, seeing counselor 1 to 2 times per month. I no longer share my morning thoughts, request a hug, give one in response to his request. It feels so awkward to live in the same house with my husband, take care of the kids, share our daily highs and lows, something we appreciate about the other person, but never touch or share our pain. I believe that during our 9.5 years of marriage, I have become totally enmeshed in my husband and have made him, made the family we're raising my higher power without actually moving out of the house for a temporary separation. How do I find the freedom to reestablish my sense of self and recover from my co-addiction? Or are we on the right track? One of the questions that I would want to ask here is, why? I certainly don't think that he can probably be or needs to be the primary person you talk to, but an unwillingness. I mean, I think the two of you need to probably be talking about this and talking about it a lot. To me, what you're describing is more what we refer to as pretend normal. And that even seems more insane. It's kind of like the elephant in the living room. That seems more insane than kind of the rest of it. I mean, it is what it is. Now, depending on how you share your hurts and what you're sharing about your hurts, and if you're just commenting on it, that's one thing. On the other hand, if you're also trying to get clarification on questions and things like that, that's another thing. I think it's quite normal for you to want him to be able to understand, which is typically when someone is sharing their hurts, the reason they do that is because they really want the other person to at least respond, kind of knowing ultimately what it's done to them. So let's see. You know, if sorry, I'm over here thinking. Sorry, bad when you're on a telephone call and you're the only one talking, you know, get too quiet, everybody goes, anybody there. I just hope there's a way, again, and maybe it's with a counselor together, that you can continue to kind of process, because I do know that you want him to understand more or less kind of what your pain is, and hopefully over time you can get to that place. Now, in terms of your sense of self, I think that part of what you're doing is really good, being in involved in counseling, getting involved in support groups, working your own program, focusing on your own prayer, your own kind of personal growth. That's going to be the best way to get your sense of self back, I think. I think that's a good approach that you're taking right now. And the things you've talked about in terms of prayer, affirmations, journaling, reading, seeing counselors, I think those are going to be really helpful. But just living in pretend normal is also a little bit frightening to me. So I hope you can find a way of communicating that will ultimately work for the two of you. Let's see. And the last thing I would suggest is, if you're not in Harboring Hope, I would get in Harboring Hope, because I think that that sort of thing can help you, give you additional support from other women that would be very, very useful and maybe help you to gain new perspective. And like I said, I'm hoping that in the long run you're going to be able to maybe talk and process some more. And may just need to figure out some ways for the two of you to talk about it that keeps it safe and allows you to go forward. Let's see. So, hi, Rick. So, in EMS, I posed this question but forgot to get it answered. My bad. I should have answered it anyway. This being the third time I've caught my husband lying and hiding pornography and masturbation, I want to draw a line in the sand that I expect him to disclose to me or his accountability partners his times of struggle or even failure. The most painful part and what I'm not sure I could and what I'm not sure I can continue to stay in the marriage over is hiding and lying. And me having to catch him each time. Is it unrealistic? Is it an unrealistic expectation to demand that he gives full disclosure immediately with any failure? He's shown that he can reach out to his accountability partners or me if they were not available, as he struggles during the time of separation between the two of us. I don't think it's, I mean, ultimately, this, the goal of this thing is to detoxify the shame. It's to get rid of the shame. It's to, I think, begin to understand that this isn't us. I mean, the person that's an addict, it's not what they want. It may be what they've done. It may be what they did. It may be a compulsion, an itch that they want to scratch, but it's not what they want. However, also learning to be brutally honest and rigorously honest and looking at this thing often takes time. In most of the programs that I've been involved in, they would say that it's actually even progress and not perfection. So what I think you want to do in the long run is, I think his ability to disclose, I think the two of you need to decide what are the boundaries around disclosure. And initially, if he's just able to get into his men's group and work and at disclosing to them, a lot of times he may not find that, and I'm, again, not making an excuse, but for many people that are just beginning recovery that are really shame-based and have never been able to talk about it, the only time they're able to truly disclose what's going on is in the group. It's not something that after they do it, they go into a shame cycle. It's very frightening for them to tell anybody. What typically causes them to begin to share is the fact they're in the group and they're watching other people just really rip their chest open as they work their own program, and they see the other person's just, you know, kind of brutal honesty, and eventually they just sit there and go, you know, well, doggone it, if they're doing it, then I'm going to do it. And then it's almost the example set by the other people in the group that allows them the wherewithal to begin to share. So if he's in a group where there's that type of honesty and transparency, then I would say it's probably going to start. I mean, his ability to immediately disclose may be somewhat limited. You know, it may really begin a process a process where as he's in the group and he learns to get better at it, then eventually he'll develop the skill where he can talk to you. And depending on who the accountability partners are, I think that there can be, and how he's got that set up, by the way, there can be kind of a determination or a decision made about what information is shared with you, and the group can be asking him if he's sharing the information with you. I would hope that whole group of accountability partners, whatever he's doing, begin to work with him and help him. And one of the goals gets to be honesty, not just, you know, trying to control pornography. In fact, like I would say, I'm with you, the honesty is probably far more important than his not looking at the pornography. So hopefully, you know, that would help a little bit. And maybe it's something, maybe he can ask a question, or you can ask him if he would like to ask a question on this thing. Now, and I agree with the line in the sand where you're drawing it there. What you don't want is the secretiveness, because remember, infidelity is the keeping of secrets. And if he keeps secrets, that's the thing that ultimately kind of leads down the pathway to create far more troubles, far more problems. So Let's see if he can post a question, and we'll see if we can set something up to get his affair group going. And like I said, the only thing I would say is full disclosure immediately. He needs to get full disclosure. But for years, I was in a group, and guys were actually moving toward that. But what they found was a lot of times they always – it was easier to kind of deal with the shame and detoxify it in the group each week. And then they would talk about going and letting their mate know. So it almost – even for these, I think, very, very good men that I was working with, the first place they could be honest was with other people, and then they took it to their mate. So the immediate is the only thing I would have a question. It may be really hard for him. Here's one from Denny. How does one develop the maturity necessary to become a functioning partner in a mature relationship after operating on a 12-year-old level their entire life? I don't really expect an answer in a nutshell, but any insight would be good. Time is short, and the need is urgent. So, you know, probably there are a lot of things that help us become more mature in relationships. I actually know you've done a few of them, kind of learning what mature looks like. If you can hang around mature people, actually, that is not a bad way to begin to move forward with being more mature. I've always thought in some ways when you meet somebody who gets it and they respond in a different way, ultimately it sets a different example. However, if you just hang around people who are amazingly immature and you're the most mature of the immature ones, what we call you're the world's shortest midget, or tallest midget, not the shortest, you're the world's tallest midget, that type of situation isn't going to help. Also, I think reading material about love, because to me, anytime it comes down to being mature, there's got to be almost a developed concern for another person. You know, those five messages that Richard Rohr talks about that I think are so important, that a mature person understands that life is hard, and so they're not disappointed when, you know, it is ends up being that way. They understand that they're not that important, but that other people are. They understand that life isn't about them. The immature person is always self-centered, and you got to know life isn't about you. You're supposed to be about life. You've got to know also to be a mature person that you're not in control. And as long as you think you can manage and control, you'll end up being incredibly immature, because now you can't really accept people and love people. Instead, what you're going to be doing is trying to change people and control people. And the last one is you're going to die. And just kind of accept the point, the reality, the fact that we've all got only so much time, you know, on this planet. And in a sense, we all, you know, are going to die. And when I can kind of quit living in kind of denial of all of that and just begin to accept it, then I'm able to eventually, I think, live a much fuller life, which is what I want to be able to do, is kind of learn to love other people. So make love the goal, and you'll end up being an amazingly mature person. It's almost like some of the things we've talked about, you know, each day, make it your goal to just try to love them in new ways that you haven't been able to do in the past. Let's see. What does a couple do when the hurt partner needs to see appreciable change and the unfaithful partner says they are trying, but the effort is not visible to the human eye? And I'm not talking about my husband. First off, when I'm working with somebody who's been unfaithful, Jesus has a really funny thing he taught, not funny, but he just says, you know, don't do your acts of righteousness before men to be seen by them. And because ultimately, you know, you'll get your reward on earth rather than heaven. That ultimately you don't do things to impress other people. It's not about getting the praise of people. It's about trying to please God, not please people. However, I always try to teach the unfaithful spouse that this is the one exception to that, and I hope the Lord doesn't mind me saying that, but man, I'll tell you, I think it's terribly important for the unfaithful partner to let their mate see things they are doing to just work on themselves, because that's what begins, at least for, the hurt spouse, to begin to have hope. I mean, if Stephanie didn't see me, I think, broken over what I'd done and working toward never doing that again, if there weren't things she could see, I would think it would be very difficult for her to believe that that I wouldn't do it again. Even if I say I won't, that really carries no value. I mean, I think it's weird that people sit there and say they won't ever do it again, because now they really they don't want to. But what's crazy about all of that is, you know, when you got married, you didn't want to do it, and you still did it. And so just because you don't want to do it, in no way is an indicator as to whether or not you will or you won't. In fact, there's some research that would say the more you don't want to do it, the more likely you are to do it. So we know that in change, you know, my intentions will always be, or almost always be, unless you're dealing with a sociopath or something else, to not do it. But that's just not a predictor as to whether or not someone will not do it. But if someone takes responsibility and accepts that they very well could do it, then they work really hard at not putting themselves in situations where something could happen. I mean, I went so far in my own recovery, and I'm not trying to set myself out there. People have to find their own peace. But I told Stephanie that if it ever came to a place where she didn't see me pursuing my spiritual growth, pursuing God, where, you know, I was trying to grow and move forward. I mean, if I ever came to a place where that was unimportant to me, I told her she needed to divorce me, that she needed to always be able to witness that sort of work in me, because I know that I'm not safe. And I know I'm not safe because I've already done it. Like I say, I don't know whether someone can do what I did if they haven't done it, but I do know that someone like me who's done it is more than capable of doing it, because I already proved I'm capable of doing it. And so I live with the understanding it's, you know, potentially, you know, it's a real potential. And so I'd make every effort possible to try to keep that from ever, you know, happening again. And so it just, again, I would hope that any unfaithful spouse is willing to kind of look at, what do I need to do to make sure that I protect my family and that I'm safe? You know, it is disturbing to me if, and of course, I don't know in this particular thing what this person is or isn't doing. But certainly, it's sad to me when someone just says, okay, I'm sorry, get over it. But, you know, they're not able to understand the impact of this thing and just give a little bit of assurance to their mate by, you know, exploring it, looking at it, talking about it. Maybe this is a comment for one of the ones earlier, but, you know, if I hit somebody's car today, hopefully I'm going to be more than willing to take responsibility for hitting their car, their parked car, and be willing to pay for the damages and do what's necessary to help them heal. And so if no one's making an effort, then it's kind of sad. But hopefully this person will kind of get to the place where their mate can see what they're doing. Let's see. I believe that is all of our written questions. Does anybody that's on the call have a question they'd like to ask verbally? Because we've got several people here. They could actually, oh, there she goes. She's clicked off. I bet she's fixing to talk. Does anybody have a question they'd like to ask?
I was just getting ready in case something came to mind.
Okay. Because obviously you don't have to if you don't want to.
No, I always have questions. Could you talk a little, a little bit about the value of meditation, especially for the, well, for either the hurt or the unfaithful?
So the, to me, in order for this experience to ultimately be transformative, you almost have to have a paradigm that you understand this thing through. And I guess to me, meditation has just the ability to focus on something different. I want to move beyond my own egocentric self, my own what I would call deceived self, the part of me that thinks that I'm all that important or I'm all that good or whatever. And I know that for most people, they don't become less self-centered unless they first figure out that they're not the center. But when people have like a God experience or in meditation they begin to sense something bigger beyond themselves, then that basically destabilizes the ego. And when you can destabilize the ego, suddenly you have to begin to consider that maybe you're not all that. Maybe it's life isn't about you, and maybe you need to get out of the center. The way, I guess the way I describe it, as you know, is that we're all born completely eccentric, and we're off center. We're not in the center of life. We're not in this. I mean, we think the world rotates around us. In fact, for every baby, if you think about it, they're all born 100% totally self-centered, and it's, I think ultimately when we get into this situation, and the reason that meditation is so important and why we need transformation, Einstein says you can never solve a problem by the same consciousness that created it. And so I really want to change my consciousness. I want to change my understanding of what life is about, what I'm about, what God is about. And meditation, again, ends up being, in my mind, the process by which that begins to happen. And when I can ultimately move out of my, what I call calculative mind, because in my egocentric self, it's basically critical. It's constrictive by nature. It's always about how well I did. It's about personal gain, it's about cause and effect, it's about trying to understand, it's about trying to justify, trying to defend the small self, and I see myself as negative, or I'm always judging other people, and so it tries to operate by kind of justifying its existence. In the true self, when I think I'm centered in God, it's really not about any accomplishment. It's accepting the fact that, believe it or not, God actually loves me, cares for me, I'm important to Him. And the goal of meditation isn't for me to be better. The goal is for me to be weaker. And I always say people never fail because they're weak. They only fail because they're strong and they're pride and they think they ought to be able to do it. Meditation actually allows me to let go of pride. It allows me to accept that I'm not all that. It allows me to let go of shame, even the belief that I was supposed to be all that. And it begins to, I can, in meditation, push away or let go of all the negative thoughts and move into the deeper waters of my soul that I think are really characterized far more by something that's expansive. something where I begin to understand that, you know, there's nothing for me to fear, that in, you know, Christ I have all things, however you look at that, but you know, apart from him I can do nothing. And so now the goal gets to be not about trying to imitate being good, but it's about participating with that which is good. It's about an acceptance of, and maybe even an understanding that I don't have to be good. I just want to get the prattle out of my head. I always say my biggest temptation, and maybe the worst temptation I've got, is to be good rather than living in acceptance that maybe I need a God. And, you know, maybe we all need saviors. And meditation, I think, allows me to get to much deeper realities. And typically the best way to get to deeper realities is through these circumstances. So, let's see. Anybody else have a question? Well, it's quiet. Let's see. Here's a question. After what my husband has been forgiven, how do I respond when he gripes to me about the ungodly behavior of others in his office life? Oh, I mean, that's a great question. I think that, again, it comes down to how you live life. And my thought is, if he's griping about others in his office life, I would say that he's still probably unable to forgive himself. And because it's how you ultimately get to mercy. You know, when you begin to see that you're not all that and you don't have to protect the self, and it's really about grace and it's really about love and mercy, judgmentalism just isn't there anymore. Now, I'm not saying that I might not even at times have other people I complain about. Hopefully I'm not judging them. But mostly I don't want to judge. You know, I want to be able to say, wow, you know, they must be really jacked up to be asking like that. You know, hopefully they're going to be able to find peace too. But it doesn't cause me to lose my peace. You know, I think that when it's almost like when Jesus taught that we never have an excuse to be offended. I try really hard not to take an offense. I'm not saying there aren't annoying people in the world that I might complain about at times, but hopefully I'm never taking up an offense. I find myself batting through my lip not to remind him how I forgave him for his infidelity. He gripes at those at church too. Again, I would just say he hasn't totally gotten it yet, and for a lot of people it is a much more of a journey. I, you know that I understand this far better 25 years down the road than I understood it, you know, 5 months down the road or even 5 years down the road. And thankfully, I will say that Stephanie was patient with me, letting God deal with me at the pace with which she was going to deal, what God was going to deal with me. You know, you might even say, you might ask the question, what makes their offense different, you know, or than kind of yours, or when I fail? I mean, what's the problem with failure? What are we supposed to learn from failure when people, you know, aren't responding the right way? I mean, why is that, do you think? But there's also a really good book. There's a couple of good books he could read that might help with that if he's a reader. What one book, if he's grappling about those at church, that he might enjoy would be The Signature of Christ by Brennan Manning, or The Ragamuffin Gospel by Brennan Manning. Both of those books, I think, do a beautiful job of talking about love, and that love is the response, that never was about other people getting it right. It was really about my ability to love other people. And it's a shift in thinking. I mean, you forgave him probably out of love. and it was a gift. You know, you got the blessing from giving him. I mean, it's, but on the other hand, if he's still believing that it's about behavior and having to hit a standard and it's acceptance is based on performance and it's requirement based, he still hasn't understood love and he still hasn't understood grace. So reading kind of in those areas and trying to understand it would be something that would be useful for him. Let's see. Any other questions that anybody wants to ask here? Oh, that's great. Thanks. Well, you're very welcome. And I wish you were there so I could talk to him also. Okay. Well, then I guess, unless somebody speaks up, we'll just end the call for today and give everybody an extra 15 minutes to go grab a bite to eat before they get on to the 1 o'clock workload and get back to work again. Hope you guys have a great week, and I look forward to talking to you next Monday. Everybody just be sure to keep praying for one another, and see you then. Bye-bye.